Hi, everyone. I'm Jack. I wanted to do a sermon series on 1 John because I feel like this book does not get as much airtime in church. Excuse me. I feel like this book does not get as much airtime in church as the Gospels or the letters of Paul. And it contains some of the strongest articulations of the meaning of the gospel in the New Testament, including the singular, endlessly quotable, paradigm-shifting statement, God is love. I'm actually going to move over here because...
Yeah. Yes, do it.
I don't need the sun to be directly in my eyes. As with much of the Bible, there's a lot we don't know about 1 John. We don't actually know who wrote it. It's called 1 John because... early New Testament scholars noticed a resemblance in its language to the Gospel of John, and so they concluded that it was written by the same author. But even the Gospel of John was given that name arbitrarily. We have no actual reason to believe it was written by someone named John. It's also not clear that 1 John was in fact written by the author of the Gospel of John, so we can't even say that. It's also unlikely that the author of 1 John is the author of 2 and 3 John, for reasons I won't get into, but my point is that we don't know who this author is. There is evidence to suggest that it was written in Asia Minor, what is modern-day Turkey, but where exactly it was written, we don't know. Nor do we know to whom it was written, nor do we know the occasion for the letter. Scholars suggest it was written to provide clarity and comfort for a group that had experienced a serious separation from another group in their community, but the details aren't clear. So unfortunately, much will have to remain a mystery with this text. But mysterious texts are all the more intriguing. They inspire wonder as well as curiosity. So let's dig in and see what this text makes us wonder. It often happens when I'm reading the Bible that I encounter something of a crisis. The text will use absolute language, making the stakes of understanding or not understanding its message exceptionally high. But it also uses terms that are tantalizingly open to interpretation. So it at once tells you, if you don't understand, you're in danger, but also provides little hope of you actually understanding. Today's passage is one of those for me. Light and darkness, truth and lies, sin and righteousness. What is the light and what is the darkness? What is the truth and what is the lie? What does eternal life mean? I want to know what it means, but reading the text, the impression that I get is that I better make damn sure I know what it means. The terms seem to suggest an in or out dynamic. The text says, if we walk in the light, we will have fellowship with one another. So walking in the light makes us part of the community, and walking in darkness separates us from the community. It makes me wonder if this text is exclusionary, if this community is a special club for purists, where outsiders are unwelcome. That kind of dynamic is so common in religious circles, and it's really toxic. So I read this language and I get a little uncomfortable. The language here also paints a dualistic picture of reality. There's light and there's darkness, and never the twain shall meet. I don't find that these absolutes ring true in my experience. I don't know if any of us are all good or all bad. People are multidimensional and complex. There's light and darkness in everyone, I think. So I question how helpful it is to speak as if you can walk in the light and not walk in the darkness, and vice versa. Finally, I question the narrative of purification this text implies. Sin here seems to be something that marks you, that defiles and stains you. We need Christ to cleanse us from unrighteousness. This is a common narrative in the Bible, but I wonder how helpful it is really. Do our actions really make us unclean so that we need some spiritual purification in order to be made right again? But I'll stop picking the text apart for now and start trying to shed some light on what it is trying to say. In order to get a better understanding of what the author meant by all his key terms, I read through the rest of 1 John and pulled out verses where the author clarifies their meaning. Let's start with light and darkness. What does walking in light look like, and what about its opposite? In chapter 2, verse 10, it says, "Whoever loves their siblings lives in the light." In the verse before, it says, "Whoever says, 'I am in the light,' while hating one of their siblings is still in the darkness." So fundamentally, whether we are walking in the light or in the darkness is dependent on whether we are following Jesus' commandment to love our neighbors. The same is true of what the author says about truth and lies. In chapter 2, verse 4, it says, "Whoever says, 'I have come to know Christ,' but does not obey his commandments is a liar." 1 John is written with a kind of spiral structure. The author advances an argument and then turns around and restates it in other words. But each repetition contains a new element, so that the argument advances a little further, like a spiral going around and round, but progressing nonetheless. So in chapter 4, verse 10, the author restates this claim about following Christ's commandments, but clarifies, "Those who say, 'I love God,' and hate their siblings are liars." So the lie is maintaining that you love God and follow Jesus while refusing to love others. Loving God and following Jesus have to mean loving others. Full stop. This emphasis on love then informs the author's theology of righteousness. In chapter 3, verse 7, it says, "Everyone who does what is right is righteous." Brilliant, right? So helpful. Everyone who does what is right is righteous. Great. Thanks for clarifying. This statement means almost nothing if we don't keep in mind what the author continually says about love. As Elizabeth preached about last week, 1 John says love requires action. It is not realized in intentions or feelings or mere sentiments. You do love. Christ is the ultimate example of one who put love into action. Following Christ is thus fundamentally about acting like he did. As it says in 1 John chapter 2, verse 6, "Whoever says, 'I abide in him,' ought to walk just as he walked." This gets confused in a lot of Christian circles. A lot of Christians seem to think that the Christian life is just about praising Jesus for washing our sin away. They seem to think Jesus did the right thing so that we don't have to. The gospel of forgiveness gets turned into this message of non-obligation. Jesus was righteous in our stead, so we don't have to live as Jesus lived per se. We just have to believe in him and give thanks to him for forgiving us. But here in 1 John, it says no. Following Jesus means doing what Jesus did. Following this train of thought, chapter 3, verse 16 says, "We know love by this, that Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for one another." And the author clarifies in the next verse that loving others means helping those in need. For it says, "How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a sibling in need and yet refuses to help?" So righteousness is loving action toward those in need, whereas sin is refusing to help. As righteousness stems from love, sin stems from hate. It is hateful action. It denies responsibility for others. It denies the humanity of others. It denies the value and dignity of others. It denies that humans are interconnected. As Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of the UK in the 1980s, said, "There is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families." This denial of interconnectivity, this denial of co-responsibility, is ultimately a basic contradiction of the teaching of Jesus. For Jesus, we are interconnected. We are responsible for each other. Righteousness is seen in meeting each other's needs. Sin is seen in denying, neglecting, and harming each other. And the net result of sin is death. When we deny, neglect, and harm each other, we promote death. Whether it's waging war, spreading a virus, cutting healthcare and food assistance, polluting our common ecosystem, or ignoring injustice, the wages of sin is always death. On the flip side, the net result of love and righteousness, 1 John calls eternal life. Chapter 3, verse 14 says, "We have passed from death to life because we love one another." A world based on mutual love would be a world of abundant life. Everyone's needs would be met, which means everyone would have health care, food, and housing. War and oppression would be abolished, and so conditions overall would favor life. Martin Luther King Jr. called it the beloved community. The Bible calls it the New Jerusalem. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, "Know the Lord," it says in Jeremiah, "because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest," declares the Lord. Think of the history of Jerusalem, how much bloodshed and death, war and oppression have shaped it for thousands of years. Can you imagine a new Jerusalem, a Jerusalem where all people, Christians and Muslims and Jews and people from every nation and faith, are motivated by love for one another and concern for each other's needs? Truly then, we would all know God. For as 1 John says, God is love. Now, as a little kind of addendum to my sermon, which I was kind of disappointed with earlier today, I want to share with you, I've been writing a poem a day for July with a group of friends, and I wanted to share today's poem, which I wrote on the subway earlier, well, while I was walking a dog and then while I was on the subway. It is possible to feel good when the world is bad. When you take a walk, meditate on all that you love. Do something you love all the days you live on this earth. Be with who you love as often as is possible. Make a religion protecting your precious goodness. Make an oasis wherever it is you call home. Never trust a thought, Nietzsche said, that you had indoors.